Beautiful. You know, as we begin this morning, we're inviting the children to come forward because today our topic is above PG-13. Like last week, we've had 2 weeks of more sensitive topics. So if you have children that you would rather be escorted out of the sanctuary to a safe space with Pastor Bev, over here on this side, kids, if you'll come forward, Pastor Bev is waiting for you. And she'll escort you downstairs, and we're going to give you a minute to get here. We promise it'll be good. It'll be better than what we're talking about here. Bev, there's a bunch right above you coming down. Oh, good. Here we go. Not you. You need to be here. Beautiful. Pastor Bev has the children's this way. Don't forget to get your children from the kindergarten room downstairs. After church, last week, some of you left us with your children. I don't do children anymore, so get your children. They won't get their lunch. That way, that way, that way. You can catch them that way. I feel like I should give a disclaimer as if we were at the airport and we were getting on a plane. You know how when you take off, the pilot will say, "This plane is headed to San Francisco this afternoon. If San Francisco is not your desired location, get off now." Because that's the conversation we're about to have this morning, this afternoon. Part two of this skin we are in. When I was a child growing up, one newspaper and two magazines came to our house. One newspaper and two magazines where we lived in the Pacific Northwest on our side of the river, the Washington side of the Portland metro area. Our newspaper was called The Columbian. Here, I pulled a cover of The Columbian from May 1980, and this is what's on the cover. That was our Mount St. Helens erupting, right? This is a phenomenal natural disaster. It killed 57 people. It just laid waste for dozens of square miles, cost $1 billion in cleanup. When I was a kid growing up, the newspaper came to our house every day. My father read it every day except for Sabbath. Then two magazines were allowed into our Adventist Christian home. Now remember, if you're Christian, you're already sort of conservative. If you're an Adventist Christian, you're very conservative. We know that, right? If you're an Adventist Christian in the Pacific Northwest, you're very conservative. So, who said amen? Jory? Yeah, that's the Kool-Aid we drink up there. So, what do you think the two magazines are that are allowed into our house when I'm growing up? Two magazines only. Good Housekeeping. So I'm going Adventist on the first one, the Adventist Review and Herald. It was called the Review and Herald then. If you're the younger generation and you have no clue, this is the major journal for the Seventh-day Adventist Church, right? I pulled the cover from the same month, May 1980. Here's what was on the cover of the Adventist Review. It looks like an image you can't make out, but the edition is celebrating or remembering the day that the earth went dark in the New England states. The year was 1780, the dark day in an Adventist history that has prophetic importance. It interprets the prophecy from Matthew 25 and the little scroll in Revelation 6, and you know all of this, right? Got it. That's the Adventist Review from 1980. One more magazine that comes into our house when I'm growing up. What do you think it is? Science? What? Signs of the Times. That's a very good guess, Norm. Wrong. The Gleaner is such a good guess if you're from the Northwest. The Gleaner did come to our house, but I didn't put it on our list. It didn't quite make it to the high level, right? Here's the other one. National Geographic. Somebody said it, right? All the beautiful pictures of the National Geographic. This is the cover from May 1980. It's just like quintessential Nat Geo, right? These are the cheetahs of the Serengeti. Aren't they beautiful? And the National Geographic, it can be cheetahs or orangutan or dolphins or something from the bottom of the sea or far away galaxies. Whatever it is on National Geographic, it is beautiful from the Creator, all this nature. and all those naked people on the inside. Did you ever wonder why it was okay for all those naked people to be in your house? Am I the only one that wondered? Why do you find people on Sabbath afternoon with the National Geographic kind of hiding in the corner? When I was growing up, this is the reading material that was allowed in our house. So when I saw the January 2017 cover of National Geographic, and it looked like this, those are not cheetahs and polar bear. And I thought of my father, if he looked at this cover, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 human beings, all experiencing their humanity in very different ways. Some of them, some of them are ambiguous. They're they have no gender. Some of them are transgender. On and on the list goes, not only on the cover, but on the inside of this magazine. And I thought of my father this week, this month. If this came to our house when I was a kid growing up, my father would first burn it, second, cancel his subscription, third, make a few phone calls, fourth, he would just shake his head all through dinner and into next week. No, no, no. What's happened to the National Geographic? Friends, it's 2017, and most of the Christian community is not talking about this, but we are. In this skin, we are a gender. We've been speaking for 7 weeks now. In this skin, we're all so different, and this is beautiful and painful all at the same time. In this skin, I'm a citizen of this world with political ideas. In this skin, I'm last week, sexual. We talked about that. In this skin, I'm cultural. I live in a culture, and I breathe this air. In this skin, I'm spiritual. Next week, that's our final topic. In this skin, I'm mental. I have various capacities mentally, and sometimes I'm wounded mentally. In this skin, I am gendered. We are male and female. We find that most of the time when it's painful to be together in community, it's because we're so different from each other. In this skin, and now it seems simple, really, for Christians. Here is our text from the beginning of God's story to us, Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. So God created humankind in God's image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. It is simple and it is straightforward. We are male and we are female, and it takes both for the image of God to be imaged in the world, which is not to say that God is male or female. This is not about God's self. This is about God's will for us in the world. Male and female, we move around the world, and the world knows God through us. It seems simple until it's not. It seems simple, male and female, there aren't more categories in the sacred text. Now, if this were 5 years ago even, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago, and I said, we're going to talk about gender this morning, you might think we were going to talk about the differences between men and women, how important it is that we all get along, how important it is we take care of each other, that we honor one another and nurture. You might think, listen, this is a book I found in my daughter's bedroom this last week. She was home for one night, our Alisa. I walked into her room and found this book that says, boys are stupid, throw rocks at them. She's in her bedroom packing, picking things up. I said, Lise, where did this book come? This is a horrible book. We don't buy books like this in our house. What in the world? Boys are stupid, and if you turn the pages, you will realize you don't buy books like this. Girls are bundles of joy and gifts from heaven. Boys pick their nose in front of 7-Eleven. We don't buy these books. This book is sitting on her bookshelf. Sissy, where did this book come from? We don't read these kinds of books. What is it doing in your room? Mom, you bought it. Mama, you bought it. I would not have bought you this book. Maybe I bought it as sort of like maybe this was like a teaching tool, you know? We were having a little lesson, and we were subverting the script, and I was telling you all the reasons why we don't read books like this. She said, whatever you need to do to work it out, you bought the book. Yeah. If I say we are going to talk about gender, maybe we think it's this kind of a topic, men and women, and why we don't read books like this and promote these ideas between the gender. If it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago or 20 years ago, maybe this was our topic. But it's 2017, and the National Geographic is not alone. It tells us the conversation that's going on in our culture. In this skin, we are gendered, and we're trying to work it out. In this skin, if I said we're going to talk about gender, you're likely to think about bathroom signs and Boy Scouts. You're likely to think about lawsuits and how to protect our religious freedoms. You're likely to think about Olympic athletes and what do we do now because they come in different packages. You're likely to think, if I say gender, the triggers for all these new topics. In this skin, we are gendered, and it's a moving, swiftly moving conversation. And in the Adventist church, we're standing still. I know there are people here today who think no good thing can come of talking about this. We'll have no good resolution at the end. My conviction is we also have no resolution when we are silent, church. We cannot be silent. In this skin, we are a gender, and we are attempting to be truthful. People say, but this isn't a problem in the Adventist church. It's not us, it's out there. This is culture. This is just the movement and the trends out in the world. This is what sin looks like. It's not here. I was traveling a while ago, and the beautiful part of this story is I don't remember where and I don't remember when. Somewhere in the last 2 or 3 years, I was with a group of administrators and pastors, a large group of people, and I was listening to them share their issues, and someone said, we don't have gender issues. We don't have especially gender dysphoria, this confusion about who we are, and we don't have people transitioning from one gender to the other. It's not an issue in the church. Someone raised a hand in the group and said, excuse me, last year when school was over in our little elementary school, we said goodbye to a teacher, Miss So-and-so. And when we came back in the fall to our little Adventist school, we said hello to Mr. So-and-so. And nobody talked about it. We do have these issues. So today, we're going to talk about it. University Church. Now I'm inviting my favorite scientist. Do you want to come on up? This is, my favorite scientist. I happen to live with him. It's legal for a lot of years now. This is my husband, Kirby. You want to welcome him? He's kind of nervous. Thanks, guys. Thank you. Kirby, you, hey, tell us about yourself. What's your social security number and all that good stuff?
Yeah. I'm a pastor's wife.
Yes.
I teach at Loma Linda. I teach medical embryology to medical students, and I teach developmental biology to graduate students and biomedical students.
Okay. That's a lot of big words.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Any of you headed to Loma Linda or to medical school, graduate school, they'll be in your classroom, won't they?
Correct.
So how many of you, by the way, like you, are there in the Adventist church? How many scientists that do this kind of specialty?
I hope not a lot like this.
Okay. Okay, I'll hold my hand still.
No, that's...
Not very many.
So not very many. We have another medical school, and we teach developmental biology on most of our campuses. So there's a number of people that probably study some of the same things I do.
I want to ask you about this... We're born male or female, pink or blue, pink or blue. It's very easy in the Genesis story. We come out one way or the other. It reminded me of the video the girls watched when they were little. I think this was about the first Disney film that made it around our house, right?
Yes.
Do you remember this scene?
I do. Our little one loved Sleeping Beautiful.
Yeah, she called it Sleeping Beautiful, Sleeping Beauty.
Make it pink.
Remember that scene?
I do.
That we watched this movie a thousand times.
Many times.
Many times.
Many times.
All the way to the end, Sleeping Beauty's dress is changing from pink to blue to pink to blue, right? All the way at the very end of the story. When I read the scripture, we're male or female, it seems like it's that simple. Would you take us started with a biology class? Let's just do high school biology.
Okay. How to make it pink and blue?
Yeah. Well, not the how-to, but...
Okay.
Okay.
So, well, we'll start at the beginning. It's a sperm and an egg. The egg will have an X chromosome with it. The sperm can either have an X or a Y chromosome. When they come together, typically two X's will give us a little girl.
Okay.
Typically an X and a Y will give us a little boy.
Okay, we got all that, right? This we should know. What happens next?
All right, so I'm going to use an illustration. This is borrowed from the University of West Florida, and it's in Creative Commons. But I'm using it to talk about how we become pink and blue, so development of the reproductive system. First step that I want to talk about or make a comment to is that this is complex. It's not as simplistic as saying an X and a Y. We all start out initially the same. So at very early in development, we start out with what we call undifferentiated gonads. Both male and female were identical. You can't tell the difference.
We both have that little mass, and it's nothing
in the abdomen. Okay. Correct. And then the process actually starts to undergo changes. And shortly, we start to either make those undifferentiated gonads into the testis or into an ovary. And the process is very complex. 25 different genes are involved in the process. Disruption of any of those can change the flow and the typical outcome. And there are 13 different syndromes where these genes have been disrupted, and you get complete sex reversal from what the genotype would have been.
From one little disruption.
Correct.
Okay.
So once a testis or an ovary has been generated, you then produce hormones. These local hormones and systemic hormones that are produced. The local hormones will basically route and form the internal reproductive plumbing.
Okay.
And then we will have systemic or body-wide hormones that form your external features.
So now we look like a boy or a girl.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. And this is done by about 10 to 12 weeks in gestation.
This is young. So
this is young. First trimester.
Can you show us with the pictures? I love these pictures. And if at any point you don't understand it, somebody just go like this. Would you do that? If we need to stop and say something else, are you all good right now? You're all good. So look at these pictures. They're beautiful. Similar kind of thing with pictures.
I'm not done.
Oh, sorry. So sorry.
Thank you. I do this sometimes in my class, too. So the systemic hormones not only shape who we look like, but they also then imprint our brain, so mm-hmm. it shapes how we're going to think and form.
So the brain's now, can I say, imprinting female and male?
Yes.
Okay.
Boy and girl.
Pictures now?
Pictures now.
Cool. Look at these pictures.
Okay. So this is you a few years ago. So this is an embryo at 6 weeks gestation. At this stage, we are indifferent. If you take a look at our gonads, we look identical. Irrespective of what our chromosomes look like, at this stage, we are identical. This is 6 weeks. By 7 weeks, 1 week later, we are already starting to form our hands, and we are also starting to form our gonads. We're starting to make testes and ovaries. We're also starting to produce some of the local hormones that are going to be necessary to change our reproductive plumbing internally. This is 8 weeks of gestation. By 8 weeks, we're now taking and converting our local hormones into global or body-wide hormones. Those body-wide hormones will then start to shape our external features. And by about 12 to 14 weeks, those will be complete. And then the systemic hormones, and this is, I threw this picture, and I just love this. This is actually showing you the 8-week embryo in its environment. That's an amniotic membrane that's around it, and that's the placenta that's attached to. So it's connection to mom. So then at 17 weeks, at this stage, we have taken shape. We look like a boy or a girl. This is also the stage that we have the highest peak of our sexual hormones, the global hormones. They peak at 17 weeks and then start to regress. And it's at this time we believe that the brain is being imprinted, the DNA is actually being modified towards a male or female behavioral pattern.
It's the expression of hormones like at puberty.
It is. This is the only other time that you have this incredible increase in hormones is during gestation. This is actually during the second trimester, and then you'll never see the hormones that high again until puberty. And at puberty, they'll rise again.
Baby's going crazy.
Baby's going crazy.
Baby's going crazy in utero. So fully, everything's in place. Now it's just going to grow.
Now you're just going to grow and develop.
This is if everything works according to the script, right? If everything works according to the script that most of us operate with, but it doesn't always work this way.
Correct.
What are options?
Options? Ambiguity.
Okay, ambiguity. What does that mean?
So ambiguity would be when we can't tell whether it's a boy or girl when they're born. If you remember, this little side note, but I'm going to do it for a purpose. Remember when you were pregnant, and we were back in Tennessee, and we couldn't tell whether it was a boy or girl when we were looking at the ultrasound.
Yeah.
We send it to someone here at Loma Linda to tell us, oh, that looked a little girlish.
Yeah.
So there are times when we can't tell.
But when they're born, there are times we can't tell.
When they're born, there are times we can't tell. We now have additional tests that we can run to try to help understand what is in process or what's going on and tell mom and dad that. But there are times when you cannot distinguish between a boy and a girl based on what we see.
Okay. What are some other things that could happen?
You can have complete sex reversal. So that means your genotype or your XX or XY don't match what you look like. Mm. And so you can come out looking like a little boy, but actually have two X chromosomes. Mm. Or come out looking like a girl and have an X and a Y chromosome.
So the outside and the inside are not congruent.
All four of the systems that I just talked about, gonad, the plumbing, the external, brain imprinting, are all separate systems, but they're integrated. They all share some common hormonal control, but they're all separate and have their own set of genes that help to drive and direct their development.
Is the brain involved in that also then?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So one of the things we know with this increased level of hormone, and also by taking and actually examining male and female brains, there's a different way that the DNA is structurally changed. It's imprinted.
It amazes me that the brain can already receive that kind of imprinting. You were telling me in the earlier service about a case in medical school.
When I was a senior medical student, we had a patient that came in. I was working on the infertility clinic through OB. We had a patient come in that was coming in for a premarital exam at 20 years of age. She hadn't had a period yet, and she was worried about whether she was going to be able to have kids and whether things were okay. The physician examined her and took some blood work and said, we're going to need to run some tests and have her come back. The test came back. She had an X and a Y. Text came back that she had inability for her body to recognize testosterone or the male hormone. And so although there was elevated levels of that, her body did not recognize it and did not acknowledge it.
Is she male or female?
She is genetically XY, but she is phenotypically or morphologically female, and her brain imprinting was female. She recognized or gender identified as female.
She's walking around the world as a female.
She was. She was getting ready to get married.
In that National Geographic issue we showed earlier, there's someone similar to this. She's a 35-year-old social scientist now, works at the University of, I believe it's Nevada. She told a story very similar to this, where XY on the inside, but a woman walking around the world, didn't know that this was her story until she was 20 years old, when she was looking at her medical history. In fact, when she was 13, her parents took her to the doctor because they knew something was wrong, and they realized while she was walking around the world as a girl that she had testes inside, undescended, right? Mm-hmm. And they had to make a decision what to do. And they didn't want to have to tell her about it, so when she was the age of 17, they told her that her ovaries were precancerous and needed to be removed. Because they couldn't bear to tell her the truth of what was going on, that her body was, she was somehow not congruent and whole. And she discovers this at age 20, looking at her medical records. Am I male or am I female? And what was so wrong that they couldn't tell me the truth?
These are difficult topics. These are difficult from a patient standpoint as well. To find out you're not who you think you are is difficult.
Is this rare? These kinds of scripts that are different than most of
us. I wouldn't call it rare. I would say it's uncommon. So between 1 and 5% of the population will have some type of reproductive atypical development.
Population is?
7.4 billion.
7.4 billion. 5% of that is?
About 370 million.
370 million people. 370 million people walking around the world with something in their script that's different than the most of us, something that's incongruent.
That's not that
when I say I don't feel myself in my body.
Right.
370 million of those? We have 20 million members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, so this would be like for every one person in the church, there would be
about 20.
20 people walking around the world who are somehow out of sorts in their body. That's not a small amount. When you think about this, what are concerns that you have as a scientist?
So I'm, from a scientific standpoint, I am after understanding how this actually works. So I'm hesitant when we talk about brain imprinting. We understand that there is clear differences. We can see that there, and we can document that there's differences in what we call methylation, or changes in the actual DNA.
Of the brain.
Of the brain. Part of what we don't know is what that means to function or behavior.
We can see change, we don't know what it means.
Correct.
What other concerns?
So another concern of mine is how we put labels on this and how we treat people associated with this. In my view, labels and language that we use for individuals that are struggling with being not typical can alienate. Mm. And these are still God's children.
So how do you explain it? If you're the physician and you see the baby's born this way, or later in life we see there's internally something different, and do you say to them, this is just diversity, part of God's plan, this is a handicap, like a child with a cleft lip and palate, this is what sin looks like in the world? How do you explain this?
I explain this as saying this is not the typical process of what we expect to see. I don't use words like ideal. To be fair, to be very honest, none of us are God's ideal. And my perspective when I'm dealing with a patient is to see how we can approach a more ideal perspective, and how do we do wholeness. That's part of the mission at Loma Linda. And so the goal is, if someone, for example, I work a lot with limb anomalies. If a child came to me with a missing lower limb, a portion of the limb, if that child wants to run, we're going to try to find ways to help them run. We're going to try to elevate them so we can get them to excel with the body that God has given them. Even if we make a prosthetic limb for them, their mind knows that they're missing a limb. The mind-body connection is still there. But we are going to try to help them become the most that they can be.
We were thinking this morning, could you imagine if this was one of our girls?
Yes.
And what would you want for them? What would you want
What would I want for them? What I want for them now, that hasn't changed. You want them to be successful. You want them to have the most. In fact, what I would say, what we want for anybody we come across is to have the most out of life they possibly can. Mm-hmm. To make a difference, mm-hmm. and to feel comfortable in their skin. Mm-hmm.
Ooh, is this making sense? Isn't that amazing? Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Do you know what we're having for lunch? You do? I'm
yeah.
so glad somebody
Big
does.
Franks.
Big Franks. No, I don't think so. Can you thank him? Thank you, Kirby. Thank you so much. The word he used several times here just now, thank you, Vaughn and Mandy. The word he used here and so many times this week was, it's complex. It's complex. You got that by listening, right? This is not simple conversation. It's complex. And when it's complex, we tend to check out. When it's complex, I think it deserves our best efforts. It's a good time to dig in, church, when there isn't a simple answer. I know that we're in fragile territory. I know that there are people here today who are frustrated from last week that somehow you wish I would make an announcement from Scripture. I would find the few verses in Scripture, 4 or 5, and we would go ahead and name something as sin and something as wrong. Last week, this week, why don't we just say that same-sex attraction is wrong? Why don't we just say that all of this is pushing around in the world and society? This is culture dragging us down. It's wrong. Pastor, why don't you just stand up and dig deep and name what God hates? I want to tell you today, I don't feel called to that message. Because that message has been heard for generations from the Christian church. I don't feel called to that, frankly, because usually when we announce what God hates, it's what I'm not. When I say what's a sin in God's eyes, it's usually not what you're struggling with or necessarily what I'm struggling with, friends. I don't feel called to that. I feel called to something very, very different. In fact, we rarely stand here and condemn and name any sin. I don't believe that's my job or the church's job. I don't feel compelled to do that today. And I know we're in tricky territory, but I am really committed that the church cannot be the place of exclusion. So what do we do when we dig deep in our text, friends? Where do we go next in our Bible? What would be persuasive right now if we needed to resource our ancient text? Well, how about anything from Jesus? In fact, the great arc, the story of Scripture is the love of God, so rich and pure. How about anything from Jesus this morning? Last week we said, love God, love yourself, love one another, the great ethic of the New Testament. But we could reach for stories like the Good Samaritan, right? The one no one wants to help. We could reach for the lost sheep where God supposedly walks away from the 99 who are all saved. We could reach for stories of the lost things in Luke's gospel. But how about this one? We could reach for that scene where Jesus walks into the epicenter of his faith tradition in Jerusalem, in the temple. When he walks into Jerusalem and he sees that the religious people are standing at the door charging people for their impurities. That the religious folk are looking at passersby and travelers who are just hoping to be in the presence of the divine. And the religious folk are deciding how much it will cost them to get in. If you're a widow, it will cost this much. If you're a leper, it will cost this much. If you're a child or if you're a this, or it will cost this much. Jesus walks into the epicenter of his faith tradition, sees what the religious leaders are doing, has a little moment. He must have a moment where he wonders, have they all gone crazy? Have they forgotten the generosity of God? Which is when Jesus sort of shouts out a question which can only be answered one way. Have you not all heard? My house will be called a house of prayer for all people. End of story. We could reach for that from Scripture this morning. The voice of Jesus. I don't know why it's so difficult for the church, the large church body, all of us locally even. Why is it difficult for us to implement the generosity of Jesus? If that's not persuasive this morning, how about if we look at some other information, right? How about if we think about suicide for a minute? Just in general, suicide among teenagers. It's the second leading cause of death for kids aged 10 to 24. It's the second leading cause of death. But when we talk about suicide for people who might have different scripts than you and I, those lines, those abbreviations, LGBTQI that we use, people whose scripts might be different, when we look at that group of people, look at the suicide numbers that we have to wrestle. For people with LGBTQI issues, the suicide attempts 4 times greater for youth. For youth who feel rejection from their families, 8.4 times greater likely to attempt suicide. For trans adults, people who are making this transition from one to the other, 40% more likely that they will have a suicide attempt. You hear that number? 40% more likely. Devo, do you have the slide on this one? And most of them will make that attempt, the other one with the suicide numbers, most of them will make this attempt before they're the age 25. How about the last, that each episode of LGBT harassment increases self-harm by 2.5 times? Every time I call a name or derogatory comment or we bully, this is what happens to these folks in our world. Friends, how about we look at the study that came out this week? Let's make it real personal to us. The Seventh-day Adventist Church has never really examined our own youth and young adults, but this week a study came out from Andrews University. Three from the social work faculty have just published a report. They started with 500 students between the ages of 15 and 34. They ended up with about 310 who filled out their survey, walked all the way through. We have for the first time a study now, the impact of family rejection or acceptance on kids in the Adventist church. Just this week's the first time we can look at these numbers. Here's one graph that tells you what happens when they come home and tell their family. The family rejection on the left, my parents struggled to accept my sexual orientation. 82% said yes. One or more of my parents responded to my orientation or my gender identity as a poor reflection on them as a parent. Yeah, 65% of the parents. I was ridiculed by my family, 42%. My family used demeaning language, 37%. I was called names, and they list the names that they've been called, 20%. My parents' financial support was threatened or taken away from me, about 30%. My family blamed me for any anti-LGBT mistreatment I received. Almost 30% of these kids, their families blamed them. The study goes on to say this, that about 80% in this study were afraid to come out to their families because they knew their families would find them sinful or disgusting. They knew the church would find them sinful or disgusting. That they waited until later in life to talk about it, that they suppressed it and held on until later in life, and they lived with this internal conflict. And that for these kids in this study, 42% of them were told by their families, you are not allowed to mention this anywhere, anytime to anyone else. The numbers for church are even worse. When they ask these millennials, well, what about your church? Did you have a clergy? Did you have a church friend? Did you have a church you felt safe in? The number is about 10%. Only 10% of them felt like they could walk into a church or call a pastor or an elder or a leader or a friend in a church and feel safe. Only 10%. So where do they go? They're finding friends everywhere else. They're finding conversation partners on the street. Besides these numbers, just look at the homeless teens. Just look at the ones here in Riverside. The estimate is between 20 and 40% of homeless teenagers fall into this category of LGBTQI, some kind of script that might be different than yours, most of us here in the room today. I don't know why we don't have our answer right now. This is not difficult with this many people living at risk in the world. Why don't we throw the doors of the church open and declare this the safe place? This isn't a difficult question. We're a church with a health message. We intend to live whole and healthy in God's sight. And we have people walking around the world, the most bullied group of people right now in the world, are those whose scripts might look different than most of us here in the room today. I don't have all the answers on how we do this. Make some new friends. I've made friends with three transgendered Seventh-day Adventist Christians. It has changed my heart. Make some friends, some new friends. begin talking about it and asking these kinds of questions. What do we do next? Form a Bible study, open the Bible, and go after these difficult passages and seek to understand them. Watch the video this afternoon, the little TED Talk, the woman, Megan, who's left the Westboro Baptist Church in her video TED Talk out this week, where she talks about what it's been like to detox from a church that taught her to hate others, right? Write, get a pen and start writing and thinking. Or if you're like Kevin Strain, he's going to sing for us here in a couple of minutes. He's been writing songs, working it out. If I had to say something set to music to our friends who are marginalized, what would I say to them? How would I sing? How would I cry out of my heart? Friends, I don't have a lot of answers. In fact, that becomes one of our answers. I think of 1 Corinthians 13, you know, that love chapter we quote so often. And when we come all the way to the end, we get these verses that say, "For we know only in part. We prophesy only in part. But when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. Because when I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put to end my childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know and be known fully." This isn't talking about salvation. This is talking about love. Now I only know partially the love God intends for us to experience. Now I can only feel it dimly. I can only express it in just small shreds and fragments, but one day we'll know more. This is what I know today, that I don't know how to do this very well, but one day. I'm thinking about a meeting Kirby and I were at in December. We went to join a group of people. The Adventist Church is now beginning to talk about this issue. Our gender, our sexuality, the life scripts that we have. What is it to be honest, to be able to live truthfully, to be the experts of our own story? The Adventist Church is now starting to talk about it in small ways. We joined a group of about 40 people, administrators mostly from North America, some scientists, and a couple of pastors. On the second, third day of the meetings, when things are getting a little tense and I get so frustrated, why is this so difficult for us? We took a walk. Early in the morning, we decided to go downtown. It always helps me to go where the real people are, to see life again, to remember. We're in a coffee shop downtown. We see a lot of homeless people, right? Just the downtown street is covered with people on their foot sleeping on the streets that night. They lock all the bathrooms in the little coffee shops downtown because there's so many people who need them. So it came my turn to need a bathroom, and they told me at the coffee shop, "Oh, go down the street, because McDonald's always keeps their bathroom open. Just go on down there." So I went to McDonald's, and I see that everybody knows to go to McDonald's to use a bathroom. Everyone's in line at McDonald's. All the colors of the world and the smells of the world and all of humanity is gathered in line at McDonald's. Oh, not to eat food, to use the bathroom. So I took my place in line. There were 5-6 people in front of me, and I'm listening to the stories. They all know each other. They've all slept on the streets last night. They know the places to go. They know where they can get a deal. We're waiting. 10 minutes, 15 minutes. The woman in front of me tells me, "Might be here a while, because I think the one that just went in there, I think she's taking a bath in the sink, because you can do that if you need to. You need to take a bath in the sink." The more they keep talking, I finally hear them say, "Well, you might be able to go out and down to the Warman House and use their bathroom." I said, "What's the Warman House? How do you get there?" "Well, just go out, turn left, go down. They're the Warman House. They open it when it gets a little cold outside. We can all just go down to the Warman House." And I'm intrigued by that. How do you get in? Do you put your name on a sheet of paper? Do you get a pass? How do they know? Do they know you? "No, it's the Warman House. The doors are always open. Just go. You'll see. It's the church. Just go out the door and turn left and turn left and look for the church and you will see. Its doors are always open." I don't know all the answers to this conversation, and I'm becoming settled with that reality. I don't have to have an answer for all the difficult questions. When the generosity of God is in front of us, that's enough for me to be part of the Warman House Church. That's a church I'm interested in. You? Amen.